loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, in March, we told you about the case of Alejandra Pablos, a prominent local immigrant rights and reproductive health activist. Alejandra is a permanent resident of the United States, but when she went to an Immigration and Customs Enforcement office in Arizona for a routine check-in, she was arrested and held incommunicado. She's just been released, but is now facing deportation. Next, French President Emmanuel Macron said last night that he did not believe he changed President Trump's mind on the Iran nuclear deal, and that he expects the U.S. to pull out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action next month. He added that doing so would be bad for everyone, Iran, the European Union, and the United States. Then, teachers in Arizona walked out today in nearly 100 school districts across the state. The teachers are striking to reestablish education funding to the level where it was years ago. It has dropped 14% just since 2008 in Arizona, measured per student, and to stop passing tax cuts on the backs of public education. And then the CIA is actively tweeting its support for Deputy Director Gina Haspel's elevation to lead the agency. It routinely retweets articles supporting or endorsing Haspel while ignoring those that don't. This would seem to be an ethical violation. Isn't any federal agency supposed to be neutral on who may or may not lead it? And finally, President Trump told the hosts of Fox & Friends this morning that CIA Director Michael Pompeo was not supposed to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un when he traveled to North Korea over the Easter weekend. But Kim walked into the room and the two spoke for more than an hour. Pompeo later said that Kim was very smart, a revelation for U.S. policymakers. But does the U.S. really know nothing about the North Korean leader? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the case of Alejandra Pablos. In March, we told you about Alejandra Pablos. She's a prominent local reproductive health activist here in the Northern Virginia area. Alejandra is a permanent resident of the United States. But when she went to an Immigration and Customs Enforcement office in Arizona for a routine check-in, she was arrested and held incommunicado. She's been released, but she's now facing deportation. Alejandra Pablos joins us from Arizona. She's an organizer with the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health, a member of the immigrant rights organization Mi Gente, and she was a delegate to the People's Congress of Resistance held last year in Washington, D.C. Alejandra, welcome.
Hi, hello. Thank you so much for having me, y'all. I'm out here in Arizona where the sun is very dry, not like in D.C.
You're there because of the teachers' walkout, the strike?
Yes, I'm actually joining all my teacher friends here. I used to be a teacher when I was younger as well, and I'm actually here in the Capitol in Phoenix joining everybody in beautiful red.
Alejandra, let's talk about what happened to you. I mean, you were arrested when you came for a routine check-in, and how long were you held, and where were you held?
Okay, so what happened to me, Trump's police force, ICE, is what happened. It's what's happening to all of us here. The ICE and Department of Homeland Security are targeting all people, especially working families and activists, as we can see. I was in Eloy Detention Center for 42 nights, 43 days, too many days for nothing. And I came in for my routine check-in after my court. I have courts here in Tucson, Arizona, where this is my permanent residence. And at a routine check-in, they decided to detain me and redetermine my custody, truly because of an arrest at a protest against DHS in Virginia, where I also organize around immigrant rights and reproductive justice.
John, this is what's happening, too. It's in the name of protecting the country from, quote, criminals, et cetera. What's actually happening is the government, the Trump administration, the Justice Department, ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, they're targeting political activists who are doing everything possible to be advocates for a community that's being targeted unjustly, immigrant families being broken up. People are standing up like Alejandra and thus then being targeted themselves.
Yeah, in fact, Governor Cuomo of New York said just this morning that ICE and CPB have become extrajudicial police forces where they're acting with impunity. They're not paying any attention to the Constitution or to federal laws, and they're just doing essentially anything that they want to do. And then we see situations like Alejandra, where here she is following the rules, observing the law, checking in for a routine, normal check-in like she has always done, and she's snatched. And this is a theme that we have seen over and over again since Donald Trump became president.
Alejandra, two questions. What was it like in this last 42 nights, 43 days? And also, we were aware, because we had guests on our show who were advocating for you, building a public campaign demanding your release. How, from your point of view, did that impact what eventually happened with your release? But first, talk about what you experienced.
Yes, that's a great question. Thank you. I mean, first of all, like you said, shout outs to the community, the national community that I do have that held me down while I was in and supported me. And that's really the reason why on April 19th, when my bond hearing was up, the judge decided that he was going to give me a bond because of all the hard work we did, even though I said I would be a flight risk. And yes, they still say you're a flight risk when you have a permanent job, you have all of the U.S. citizen family here. You've been fighting over 7 years for this case, coming into courts and checking in for over 5 years, and yet I'm still a flight risk. But that day when I got re-detained, it started opening my vision, basically. To me, the most important thing was how I've noticed how I've been gone for 5 years. I was there for 2 years in 2011 and 13. ICE and CCA have managed to allow that facility to become more and more of a prison. And I mean, not even criminals deserve to be treated like the folks that are in ELO detention center. Folks are in there asking for help, working families, like you mentioned, and they're not getting any specific medical attention. They're under a different contract. So when my roommate specifically was bleeding out of her rectum for almost 2 weeks, there was nothing she could do because you can only go and see medical between 5 and 6 in the morning. And I had to deal with seeing her cry and seeing her develop new sicknesses and diseases in there because of the neglect of the staff there, the medical staff, the different medicines people get. We don't get any benefit of the doubt. Our bodies, our black and brown bodies in detention, don't get the benefit of the doubt. We come in there seen as people with criminal records and who are not worth seen as human beings. And for me, it was astonishing for me that I'm just like, I'm here just only for an arrest at a protest, for defending my rights, my First Amendment, for talking against the injustices of the DHS offices that are literally tearing families apart. And it definitely opened up my vision to see that Department of Justice, led by Sessions, and his argument that he was never going to watch over DHS, he wasn't going to be supervising, there weren't going to be, if people are putting complaints, nobody's going to be holding them accountable. And that's what I saw at ELO Detention Center, that there's no accountability. They're not serving anybody any food, and they don't have to do better for us. You know, we come in there, we can't even touch our family members when they come to visit us. It's like I said, it's even worse than conditions for inmates in federal prisons. The mattresses are super, super thin. I've developed some really, really big knots that I'm barely recovering yet from. I still have a lot of work to do on my body, but sleeping on 2-inch mattresses on metal for more than that. And I know that the women have been there for 4 years. They're being held indefinitely. There's no accountability. Nobody's watching them. And everything that Trump is saying on tweets, it seems like it's legislation for Department of Homeland Security and ICE. And they're going rogue, and they're really targeting everybody who's speaking out. And we're not scared. We're only getting stronger and stronger because of the things that are evident coming from the administration.
John Kiriakou, what Alejandra's saying must ring with you. I mean, you spent 2.5 years in federal prison. All these people are being treated like,
yes,
like people in federal prisons.
That's right.
Or even worse in some cases. And their crime, their so-called crime, is that they're immigrants.
Yeah. I can tell you from firsthand experience that everything that Alejandra just said is true. I saw it with my own eyes. If you are sick, if there's something wrong, if you're even bleeding from your rectum, like she said that this friend of hers had been bleeding, you can go to sick call, they call it, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, or Friday from 6 to 6:15 a.m., and that is it. And if you don't get there by 6:15, and by the way, you have to make a choice. You either eat or you go to sick call. If you don't get there by 6:15, you are out of luck. And maybe you can try it the next day. Maybe you'll die between now and the next day. That's the way it is. It's a crime against humanity, really, is what it is.
Go ahead, Alejandra.
Absolutely. I was just going to share that, like I said, a lot of the women in there were also not the violent people that we talk about, you know, when they do shun us. You know, it's women who are survivors of domestic violence that were called immigration on them, right? It was folks that have had drug sicknesses that have not had any support or resources to, you know, walk a different path in their lives. It's women that have been oppressed all of their lives, and they're working. Like you mentioned, people are just with no driver's license. And now folks are even getting human trafficking charges because they were driving in a car with another undocumented person who must have been their comrade for over 20 years, but still are getting these charges. And they're going rogue. People are not, when we talk about deportations right now, the people that are deported are not for any violent offenses at all. Even myself, I come from a state where if I would have lived in a different state, not Arizona, my charges that I've had, which were DUI and the possession of paraphernalia, would be either tickets or misdemeanors. But here in Arizona, because of our sentencing structure and our criminal justice system, it's a felony and I'm due for deportation, regardless of having citizen parents and regardless of just petitioning a little bit too late when, you know, my family members didn't know about the laws, the immigration laws back then. But at the end of the day, we have to understand that Trump is enacting his white supremacist agenda and using ICE as his police force, using Sessions to enforce everything. You know, his tweets are not legislation. We're forgetting that. So people are just using the administration to also enact their own personal political beliefs. Like, you know, they put us in proximity to be criminalized more, and it's just really disgusting. Like, we just heard here in Arizona, this deportation officer killed somebody over the border, like 14, 20 times or something, and nothing happened to him, right? We're not seen as human beings here. That's why they get to do what they do and not feed us and sell us commissary really, really expensive and not give us any bonds when we're there. And people are being held indefinitely. Even deportation officers in there, their work ethic is horrible. I saw hundreds of women's cases, because I have a lot of friends who were helping out with legal cases there, where they would copy every single sheet that they would ask ICE for, right? Like, hey, I'm already deported. I need my travel documents. And would hold women for months and months even afterwards and giving them no answers as to what's going to happen. You don't know what's going to happen in there. So women are being held there indefinitely, and so are men. And even people with children, U.S. citizen children, are in detention right now with no bond because they're a flight risk.
And as things stand now, there's no recourse. You know, you can't get legal representation. Nobody in Congress cares, and you're essentially
John,
stuck.
John, I know we're out of time, but I want to just say, hearing Alejandra, it's very inspiring. It was terrible that she spent all those days in custody. People all around the country did rally for her, and that's a sign that there is a power in a grassroots movement.
But that's it. That's right.
We're going to keep following it.
Well, we were joined from Arizona by Alejandra Pablos. She is an organizer with the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health, a member of the immigrant rights organization Mi Gente, and she was a delegate to the People's Congress of Resistance held last year in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
French President Emmanuel Macron said last night that he did not believe he changed President Trump's mind on the Iran nuclear deal and that he expects the U.S. to pull out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action next month. He added that doing so would be bad for everyone, Iran, the European Union, and the United States. We're joined from London by Catherine Shakdam, a political commentator and analyst focusing on the Middle East, and the author of A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Catherine, welcome back to the show.
Thank you again for having me.
Catherine, I think all of us here in Washington hoped that President Macron would be able to change Donald Trump's mind. And indeed, the days that they spent together seemed to be so warm and so friendly that I, for one, thought we had a chance of actually seeing this through. That looks to be not the case. Assuming that Donald Trump does pull out of the Iran deal next month, what do you see happening next?
Well, it's going to be complicated. I mean, as far as, you know, changing Donald Trump's mind, I don't think that anyone can, to be quite honest with you. And I don't think that, you know, President Macron is the Trump whisperer. I know that many people have called him that. I don't think anyone is. But as far as repercussion goes, I mean, we talked about it before. I think it's going to be very tricky as far as France is concerned, or the EU as a whole. Because by reneging on the deal, then it would essentially force the EU and France to face sanctions should they decide to go ahead with the deal and therefore engage in deeper relation, you know, economic ties, for example, political ties with Iran. So it's going to be very difficult to maneuver, because how will the US manage at the same time to issue a whole new range of sanctions against Iran, renege on the nuclear deal, continue on its war path, and at the same time make good on its promises with the EU and France, you know, to have stronger ties, to be better and stronger and everything else, but at the same time forcing them to make a choice in between the nuclear deal or their relationship with the United States of America without really giving any incentive. So I think it's going to be very tricky, because I think the EU and France made very, very clear that it looks upon Iran as maybe not as a good partner per se, but at least a valid partner in that it cannot afford to not have Iran within the fold of the international community. I think it's going to be very tricky. And the problem is, I really don't think that President Trump actually realizes that he's going to have to face all of this, you know, in a few weeks' time. I think that all he sees is the promise that he made, you know, because, you know, I don't know, maybe he woke up one morning and decided that it would be, you know, a good punchline as far as the media was concerned, or maybe his Twitter account. And then now he's kind of stuck with it because he put himself in a very difficult corner, and he's not trying to be rational about it. He's just a case of, again, you know, making good on his promises, even though his promises make absolutely no sense whatsoever. Not on paper, not ideologically, and certainly not politically or economically. So he's running Washington into a hole here.
Yeah, John and Catherine, I'm looking at the statement from Brian Hook, who is the head of the State Department Planning Office. He disparaged the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Quote, "It has no signatures. It has no legal status. It's a political commitment by an administration that is no longer in office," Hook told National Public Radio. I mean, obviously, they're going out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan.
Without a doubt.
And it is a legal agreement. It's not a treaty. The reason Obama didn't make it a treaty is it wouldn't have actually passed the Senate.
No.
And it takes 2/3 majority to pass the Senate. And even the Democrats were basically more or less against Obama's initiative here. Obama, I think, was trying to reorient U.S. foreign policy instead of being bogged down in endless confrontation in the Middle East. Obama wanted to pivot towards Asia to challenge or confront China's rising status within the Asia-Pacific area. In other words, not necessarily a pristine agenda either, but a different agenda. And here you have Trump and the Trump war cabinet, because you have John Bolton, who, you know, back in 2005, the U.S., according to the Dick Cheney's plan, and Bolton's plan was to go to war against Iran. He's there. He's going to be the national security advisor. Mike Pompeo was very much a hawk against the Iran nuclear deal. Catherine, what will Iran do? Because it's one thing for France to say, we're going to stay in, but there's a lot of pressure inside Iran to say, well, look, the Western powers are reneging. The U.S. is going to sanction perhaps European countries, and they're going to decide to do business with the United States rather than Iran, even if they prefer to stay in the deal. Why shouldn't we just leave it and begin, just go out, kick the inspectors out and begin our own, not necessarily a nuclear weapons program, but a nuclear energy program without weapons, intrusive weapons inspections?
Well, they could certainly do this. I mean, I think as far as, you know, the fear that people continue to have for whatever reason that, you know, Iran is, you know, wants to be nuclear military to develop at least, you know, this kind of military capacity. It doesn't want to. If it wanted to, it would have done it ages ago. It doesn't want to for various reasons. It stated that it doesn't want to. So I would imagine that, yes, maybe Tehran will consider whether they want to go back to, you know, their research, their study in terms of, you know, civilian uses, you know, in nuclear energy. It's very possible. And again, I mean, Iran is a sovereign nation. And so, you know, in theory, they can do whatever it is that they want to do within their own borders. And I think it would be very hypocritical for anyone to actually challenge that, because, again, we are eroding our country's sovereign rights. And rather than resort to sanctions and belligerence, I think we should try to, you know, to include people in talks and diplomacy. But we tried this, and Washington is bent on reneging on this and on destroying any hope, you know, of moving forward. Because every time, you know, we have to understand, first of all, that the nuclear deal was never about nuclear, you know, Iran. It was never about whether or not Iran wanted to develop a nuclear weapon. It was more about trying to find a way forward and try to find common ground and to try to have a win for both the West and Iran, and to try to, you know, at last kind of build a bridge, you know, when bridges have been completely blown, you know, blown up and blown away since the 1970s. And, you know, this is not happening. So it's a shame. It's a great pity because Iran has a role to play in the Middle East. Iran has a role to play in the world altogether. And I don't understand why the U.S. is so, you know, bent and intent on ruining any hope of a friendly relationship with Iran. So, you know, whether it's for religious issue, political issue, it's stupid. It's just flat out stupid.
But when we're talking about the U.S. here, we're not talking about one U.S. We're talking there's Trump and the grouping around Trump. They want to sabotage this. Obviously, the Obama administration, for its own reasons, as we said, spent a lot of capital to make sure that this agreement happened. And that was going to get, you know, there were a lot of headwinds here in Washington from all kinds of quarters against doing this. Again, I wanted to just talk, John, you know, Iran does have the right to leave the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, even if it doesn't want to build nuclear weapons. I mean,
sure,
here's what it says. Here's what the treaty says. Each party shall, in exercising its national sovereignty, have the right to withdraw from the treaty if it decides that extraordinary events related to the subject matter of this treaty have jeopardized the supreme interests of its country. Now, you have Israel. It has nuclear weapons and is not a member of the NPT and is being armed to the teeth and financed full out by the United States. You have the same U.S. government now moving the capital to Jerusalem, the U.S. capital in Israel to Jerusalem. In other words, giving a green light to the most revanchist militarist impulses of the Israeli government. The U.S. has nuclear weapons. Britain has nuclear weapons. France has nuclear weapons. If they're going to be hostile towards Iran, Iran can say, well, our supreme interests are such that we're going to leave the NPT, which just leaves options open. When you think about what's happening with North Korea left the NPT, developed nuclear weapons, and guess what? Donald Trump is actually going there mm-hmm. to negotiate. Mm-hmm. What's the message here?
Yeah, I'll tell you another thing, too. In today's Washington Post, there's an article, and I think that this one sentence in this front page article is the most important. It says, international monitors, a host of foreign governments, and even the Trump administration all acknowledge that Iran is in compliance with a deal which gave Tehran sanctions relief in return for strict curbs on its nuclear program.
And it turns out not very many sanctions relief because there have been so many new additional sanctions. A lot of European countries are afraid of being, you know, paying huge $1 billion-like fines if they do business with Iran, even because there's additional sanctions outside of the nuclear issue.
Yes.
Go ahead, Catherine. We have about 90 seconds left.
Well, what I would like to say is that, you know, the picture you just painted in terms of Iran complying with everything else and yet still being called, a criminal regime is exactly the situation that you have with Israel and Palestine. So it's always the case where Israel is the bully, claiming, however, the victimhood of its victims for itself. And the same thing is happening with the U.S. and Iran for one simple reason, is that we have allowed exceptionalism to actually take hold in the way that we conduct politics and diplomacy. And that's a problem. We need to return to the rule of law and actually abide by it. Otherwise, we can't have any form of real diplomacy. We can't try to have real relationship with nations.
That was the voice of Catherine Shakdam. Catherine joined us from London. She's a political commentator and analyst focusing on the Middle East, and she's also the author of A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Teachers in Arizona walked out today in nearly 100 school districts across the state. The teachers are striking to reestablish education funding to the level where it was years ago. It has dropped 14% just since 2008 in Arizona, measured per student, and to stop passing tax cuts on the backs of public education. We're joined by Natalie Harizi. She's a teacher and librarian and a teachers union organizer. Natalie, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be with you guys.
So, Natalie, tell us what's happening today in Arizona. This strike has been bubbling up for weeks, if not longer, and finally the teachers have had enough. What do things look like today?
Today, teachers have come out to a major rally at the Capitol in Phoenix, but they're also coming out across the state as they walk out of schools. And I think if you list the list of districts where they're going to be closed on Thursday and Friday, it represents a widespread response across the state. And really, the teachers are organizing, they're rallying, they're demanding increased public funding and increased raises, but they're also really taking care of business. A lot of the critics of the walkout and the actions that have been taking place have been saying that the teachers aren't really taking care of the students in the schools. And they're doing this for the students in the schools, and they're making that known because they're organizing daycare, they're working with supporting organizations to make sure that children are taken care of, and they're doing this for the kids' future and for the future of public education. So it's a really incredible display of labor organizing and teacher solidarity and the fight for public education following, you know, major strikes amongst teachers in West Virginia, Oklahoma, and Kentucky. And, you know, the Indiana teachers are considering it as well. But the Arizona strike, the walkout, is the biggest action we've seen so far amongst the largest sort of educator population amongst those states. But still in a state where teachers don't have the right to do many of the things that they're doing, but they're fed up. They're done with the situation that has really been, like you said, bubbling over the last few months, but actually bubbling over the last decades as public education has faced cut after cut after cut. And these teachers have really been organizing. They did a sick out in March. They've had multiple rallies at the Capitol building. They've organized and organized and organized, and they're still just kind of hearing platitudes from the politicians. And they called this walkout, and they voted to do it because they're so fed up with promise after promise after organizing and organizing and not really seeing that change become a reality. And so the walkout on Thursday and Friday is really to say, you know, do this, support public education, put the money there so that our students and ourselves can live and be educated and provide education.
Well, I'm looking at a study that was just released in the last couple of months, and its findings are shocking. Brian, it says here that in terms of class size, Arizona ranks 51st in America. So behind...
And that's out of 50 states.
Out of 50 states. And the District of Columbia, it ranks 51st. In terms of teacher pay, it ranks 47th. Overall quality of education, 38th. And what does the governor do in response to this study a couple of months ago? What he did was he made it easier for people with no college degree to become classroom helpers rather than to work with the teachers' unions to try to hire more teachers, to raise pay, to raise standards. None of that happened. He just made it easier to hire uneducated people to assist in the classroom.
Everything now, John, is about whether a company or an enterprise can make profits. And guess what? Schools don't make profits. And so as a consequence, the politicians who are bought and paid for by corporate lobbying interests don't give a damn about education. Or in the case of many of them, they're ideologically opposed to public education. They're trying to crush it, like Betsy DeVos. And we have a phenomena, Natalie, where the fight back is starting. I mean, it's all over the country, but it's taking place in West Virginia, in Kentucky, in Oklahoma, in Arizona. By the way, there's big walkouts and rallies in Colorado today. Areas that have been traditionally not on the East Coast or the West Coast, traditionally not the democratically controlled parts of the country. Red state places where there's been, you know, a weakness within the labor movement, but these teachers are reviving the labor movement and creating a movement for public education. Also, Natalie, I want you to comment on this. There was you can see how the Democrats are looking at all of these teacher strikes in these red state areas from the point of view, can this be an advantage for the Democrats? Can they win some congressional seats in the 2018 midterm elections? Of course, in the case of in Arizona, a Republican won the race narrowly compared to how big Trump won it. This was a special election yesterday. But here we have a situation, and I want to also, this is tangential. Colorado is introducing new laws, I think today even, criminalizing teachers
right.
striking. In other words, if a teacher goes on strike, they say, well, you're going to be fired. It's illegal. When you look at what's happened to public education, Natalie, it's not just the Republicans. The Democrats, even Obama, too, was on a path to create charter schools, to drain money from public education. And there has been anti-union legislation that's been promoted by both Democratic and Republican governors criminalizing or making illegal the rights of unions to engage in strikes, to withhold labor for the benefit of a good collective bargaining agreement. Anyway, what's your take on that?
I mean, I absolutely agree with what you've said. I think the Democrats always look at movements like this as something, whether they can, you know, use it to their political advantage. But the fact of the matter is that they've been part and parcel of creating the situation that we're facing right now. And I think that the situation for public education in the states where people are really organizing and fighting back is a result of this complete attack on public education. But it is countrywide. It's not just in these states. In these states where unions have been, in right-to-work states where unions have been weakened, that is where teachers are feeling these cuts more intensely. But the fact of the matter is it's across the board. And just like you said, you know, the Bush administration had its approach, which was No Child Left Behind, and they always find some name for these things. And then the Obama administration called it the Race to the Top. And both of these programs, although they had very different characteristics, and they were from a Republican and a Democratic administration, both of them had the same goal. And it's been the goal of an education, quote-unquote, reform movement for even longer than the Bush administration to undermine public education, to undermine the teachers' unions and their organizing and demonize them, to continually reduce their right to organize, but also to remove funds from public education and to privatize it in the form of charter schools or other options where people can, quote-unquote, make choices. But really what it comes down to is removing the access to education for the public, and particularly the most oppressed sectors of the public. And that has left us in a situation where we have schools under the kind of conditions that people have been posting about left and right, where books are 30 and 40 years old and they're moldy and they're destroyed, and teachers get take home $300 a week and still use part of that to buy supplies to make sure their students get an education. And this is not the result of some Republican scheme. It is across both capitalist parties. Both the Democrats and Republicans have undertaken this. And I think it's very, very impressive what is going on, because what's happening is teachers, and a lot of young teachers, they're new to this profession.
That's true. We've been seeing that, John, all across the board.
A lot of the
leaders and organizers are like 22, 23 years old.
Yeah, and we've talked about the fact that it's really this younger generation now that has taken up the mantle of protest and political action, and they're really running with it, which I think is a wonderful thing for the country.
And Natalie, when you think about it, I know myself, so many people, young people who became teachers because they wanted to teach. They weren't trying to go into corporate America. And yet they leave the teaching profession in 2 or 3 years because, one, teachers are targeted, they're demonized, the pay is too low, the hours are too long, the classrooms are too big. There's no supplies. As you're saying, people have to pay for stuff out of pocket just to make sure their kids have like basic stuff in this, the richest country in the world. Anyway, that's a factor too. But perhaps if the struggle led by young teachers picks up, maybe more young teachers will actually stay to fight, not just to teach.
Right.
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, they have nothing to lose. It's a speed up in education, and the youngest teachers have the most difficult situation. And I think their leadership is really what's going to change the face of public education and make it possible for us to fight to save it, which is critical for the work we do and also for the students and families we serve in this country.
Natalie, we've got about 30 seconds left. Tell us quickly what we should expect in the coming days in Arizona. Do you think that the governor is going to concede anything here?
You know, what's really interesting is that the minute the walkout started, the Republican Governors Association put out an ad really promoting priorities that he's faced in terms of education. And I think he's really feeling the pressure, and I think they all feeling the pressure. This is a huge thing for Arizona teachers, and they actually have a lot of support despite attempts to undermine that support and demonize them in a variety of different ways. And I think that we'll have to see how it plays out, but these 2 days of organizing and rallying hopefully will have a huge effect, and they will respond. There are a lot of plans and a lot of options out there, and they can adopt plans that do immediately fund the public schools and that do fund the public teachers. So I think we can see a lot. I think we just have to pay attention to what happens over the next 2 days and do what we can to support it.
Certainly, we will come back to this issue, as I'm sure most of the mainstream media will as well. We were joined by Natalie Harizi. She's a teacher and librarian and a teachers union organizer. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The CIA is actively tweeting its support for Deputy Director Gina Haspel's elevation to lead that agency. It routinely retweets articles supporting or endorsing Haspel while ignoring those that don't. This would seem to be an ethical violation. Isn't any federal agency supposed to be neutral on who may or may not lead it? We're joined from Arlington, Virginia by Ray McGovern. Ray was a CIA analyst under seven presidents and was also the personal morning briefer for President George H.W. Bush. Ray, always great to have you.
Thank you, John.
Ray, I'm looking at the agency's Twitter feed, and just in the last day or two, they tweeted an article from the Washington Examiner, and it's entitled "The Parade of Falsehoods About CIA Nominee Gina Haspel." And just hours earlier, they tweeted something from CBS News entitled "CIA Releases Report Clearing Haspel in Destruction of Waterboarding Tapes." Well, that's ludicrous. It's propaganda. Have you ever seen anything like this before?
Well, nothing quite like this. Of course, you know who's running the CIA right now.
It's none other but Gina Haspel.
So, you know, as bad as it is, even the press is missing the boat here. They're saying, oh, the CIA is doing this. The CIA is trying to support Haspel. Well, Haspel's running the CIA, for God's sake. And that shows how bad she is. It's it reminds me of when Hayden, after General Michael Hayden had been pretty much shown to have approved illegal wiretapping of all of us, all of a sudden, George W. Bush named him head of the CIA, or nominated him. And I remember Bobby Ray Inman at the New York Public Library. He says, well, Hayden clearly violated the law. And another NSA former director said, you know, he should be court-martialed for doing that, you know. And yet he sailed through. But in those days, they depended on old colleagues, you know, old soldiers never die. Now Haspel's doing it herself. More power to her if she can get all the press to say it's the agency doing that. It's Haspel. It's pretty transparent.
Tell me, Ray, what happens on Capitol Hill when someone is named CIA director and they're a career CIA officer? How does that work out? They're already inside the agency at a senior position, usually deputy director. The appointment is made. They go up to Capitol Hill to begin lobbying for themselves. And then what?
Well, it all depends on whether there's any integrity in the committees. In this case, of course, you have the Senate Intelligence Committee run by Richard Burr from North Carolina. Now, what's the first thing he did when he came into chairmanship? Well, he recalled all the Senate investigation copies of CIA torture based on CIA original documents. Well, that shows you where his heart lies. So he's already spoken in favor of Haspel. There's lots of people who have. But, you know, something happened just this afternoon, and that is that the National Security Archive from GW University put out a long, very detailed rendition of what they gleaned from the documents that they've gotten and that other people have gotten through court cases and other means, showing that she's as guilty as sin, and chapter and verse is included in all these. So it's going to be hard for all those senators on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence to ignore all that. You know, if you look at the genesis of why our country ended up doing torture, well, there are three presidents to blame. One is George W. Bush. One is Obama. Obama was intimidated from holding the torturers accountable, and now we have President Trump naming a torturer-in-chief, Gina Haspel. Yeah, it's quite remarkable that we have three in a row that have no conscience or are intimidated from surfacing what really happened. One thing people don't really know much about, because it only appeared in the Guardian newspaper when it was telling the truth, Spencer Ackerman, who at that time was a really good journalist, interviewed the chief investigator for the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and there were three installments, and one was really blistering because it showed Obama carrying water for John Brennan, pleading at every juncture, no, we can't declassify this. No, we can't do that. And it was only at the very end, before the committee turned over the chair to Richard Burr, that to her credit, Dianne Feinstein said, look, Mr. President, all due respect, we have a fellow on our committee who's willing to read the thing from the floor. So you have a choice. You want this fellow to read it from the floor, or do you want to release the reacted version? And that's the only thing that got Obama to release it. So that's how intimidated these folks are. That's how bereft of any respect for international or indeed national law they are.
Ray McGovern is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. We're talking about the mounting opposition around the country on all kinds of different levels against the appointment, the nomination of Gina Haspel as the next CIA director. And we're also talking about the fact that the CIA Twitter feed is alive defending Gina Haspel. And as Ray McGovern points out, not that shocking given the fact that the CIA is currently being run by Gina Haspel. So Gina's tweeting right now. We're having her minions tweet. John Kiriakou, you wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post, which helps stimulate a lot of this opposition. I went to prison for disclosing the CIA's torture. Gina Haspel helped cover it up. People can read that in the Washington Post. Just Google that title. I went to prison for disclosing the CIA's torture by John Kiriakou. In that article, John, you wrote, the CIA will not let me repeat her resume or the widely reported specifics of how her work fit into the agency's torture program, calling such details, quote, currently and properly classified, close quote. But I can say that Haspel was a protege of and chief of staff for Jose Rodriguez, the CIA's notorious former deputy director for operations and former director of the Counterterrorism Center, and that Rodriguez eventually assigned Haspel to order the destruction of videotaped evidence of the torture of Abu Zubaydah. The Justice Department investigated, but no one was ever charged in connection with the incident. That's a big part of this story, the destruction of the videotapes. Of course, the CIA under Gina Haspel is now saying, quoting media accounts saying, not true.
Yeah, the CIA is trying the Nuremberg defense for Gina Haspel, that she was just following orders. And then, of course, they dutifully tweet out this article saying she's been cleared. Well, she's been cleared by them, and they were the ones that then wrote that article. I will say there's one thing that I'm very, very proud of. What it is just a couple of days ago, 109 retired flag officers, 109 retired generals and admirals sent an open letter to the members of the Senate Intelligence Committee asking them to reject Haspel as the CIA director. I spoke with one of those generals day before yesterday, and he said that they have a listserv where they stay in touch and pass around interesting articles, just like Ray and I do with other former colleagues from the CIA and the FBI and elsewhere. And one of them saw my op-ed in the Washington Post and circulated it. And it was that was the impetus for them to write this letter. Now, in response, the CIA, and they just tweeted this recently, tweeted an article entitled Full Court Press for Haspel, Letter from 50 Former Officials. Well, who are those 50 former officials? They are everybody that ever had anything to do with the CIA's torture program. People like Mike Morrell and Jose Rodriguez and Jim Pavitt.
So maybe it should be called like Torturers Unite.
That's right. That's what it comes down to. And so, it's up to people like Ray here to coordinate and organize the response. And that's really what we're doing. We're working with these generals. We're working with other organizations, with the American Psychological Association, with Human Rights Watch, with other concerned organizations, to make sure that our voices are heard as well, and that we do everything we can to block this nomination.
Go ahead, Ray.
John and Brian, it should be possible. I have a basic faith in the goodness of American citizens if they weren't deceived, okay? I think they basically understand that human beings don't do those things to other human beings, okay? Torture's not bad because it's against the law. It's bad because it's intrinsically evil, okay? Always evil, okay? Now, you can sort of branch out and say, well, yeah, but it could work. Yeah, but if it's real urgent, after 9/11, we thought another one. Yeah, well, you know, the other thing is it doesn't work. And I was an infantry officer, okay? I was a combat infantry intelligence officer. So we dealt with refugees or captives or detainees, what do you call them these days. And I will just like to quote the head of Army Intelligence. Right after George W. Bush advanced the notion of what he called an alternative set of interrogation procedures, later became known as enhanced interrogation techniques, right out of the Gestapo manual, by the way, literal translation. But here's what General Kimmins said, head of Army Intelligence, 1 hour before he knew George Bush was going to say something very different. Quote, I'm absolutely convinced that no good intelligence is going to come from abusive practices. I think history tells us that. I think the empirical evidence of the last 5 years, hard years, tells us that. Last 5 years, we're talking 2006, we're talking Gina Haspel and Rodriguez and all those people who started it 5 years before. Ed Kimmins knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he knew that it was bogus, despite what Hollywood says, despite what the Hollywood division of CIA says, all right?
It's not legal, it's not ethical, it's not moral, and it should not be done. But we're going to have to leave it there, Ray. We were joined from Arlington, Virginia by Ray McGovern. Ray was a CIA analyst under 7 presidents, and he was also the personal morning briefer for President George H.W. Bush. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
President Trump told the hosts of Fox and Friends this morning that CIA Director Michael Pompeo was not supposed to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un when he traveled to North Korea over the Easter weekend. But it turns out Kim Jong-un walked into the room and the two spoke for more than an hour. Pompeo later said that Kim was very smart, a revelation apparently for U.S. policymakers. There's also news stories in the media today, John Kiriakou, that the U.S. actually doesn't know anything about Kim Jong-un or the North Korean leadership because they're desperately trying to build portfolios and provide biographical information so that they can suss out who Donald Trump will be meeting with. A dearth of intelligence on North Korea.
Yeah, there are several different things that we can discern from this statement from Mike Pompeo and from the White House. Number one is the U.S. just simply doesn't have any sources of intelligence in North Korea. If you don't know the most basic information about the leader of a country, it's because you have literally no clandestine sources inside that country. That ought not to surprise us. There are lots of places where the CIA doesn't have any sources. And then in the end, oftentimes we pay a price for that. But another thing that's interesting, and it's always been interesting to me, is that all major intelligence services, every one of them, collect biographical information on leaders in other countries. And that is to prepare their leaders for meetings with foreign leaders. For example, if you like to play chess, that's a good thing for me to know. And so my analysts will put that in your biography and maybe I'll want to play chess with you. But it can also be a little bit more cloak and dagger. In that, if I know that you like to play chess and you like to go to bed early, and I'm the president of the United States and you're visiting me, I'm going to invite you to play chess, but I'll do that late at night. So the next day, you are too tired and you'll end up giving me something. Now,
is that a hypothetical?
It's not a hypothetical.
Okay. I know you don't want to get in trouble. I understand. Okay.
I'm trying hard here. I'll tell you where this started. This started at the Yalta Conference in 1945, and that was where Joseph Stalin, Franklin Roosevelt, and Winston Churchill met. Now, why Yalta? Churchill had to go all the way from the UK, but more importantly, Roosevelt had to travel all the way from the United States, literally around the war. So he had to go from the U.S. to Iran and from Iran to Yalta. Well, Roosevelt was sick, very sick, and ended up dying just a month or two later. Well, Stalin knew that Roosevelt was sick, and so he demanded that the meeting be in Yalta. By the time Roosevelt got there, he was exhausted and he gave away Poland. And so the U.S. government learned a lesson with that experience. And as a result, they have always tasked the CIA and other intelligence community members with collecting as much background information, as much biographical information as possible on literally every foreign leader that they encounter or on any person who might someday become a leader.
So, John, that's an interesting story about Yalta, and I have heard it. But I do want to say, I want to bend this a little bit backward. The Red Army was already in Poland.
I know.
I mean, they had liberated Poland from the Nazis. So, yes, maybe Roosevelt was in a weakened position. But your point being that the psychological profile of leaders really makes a difference. Now, there's a lot, you know, when you think about what we're talking about, American media constantly, you know, demonizes North Korea for being a closed society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But what you're telling us, and you're a former CIA person, is if it was a more open society, at least from one point of view, from the point of view of intelligence gathering,
yes,
that would be very much to the advantage of an intelligence agency that wanted to collect information on DPRK.
And to the detriment of North Korea. So there's something to be said for not... I mean, this isn't my own personal position, but there's something to be said for not having an open society in that respect.
Yeah, like if you feel like, in other words, if you feel you're a small country targeted by a very big country, like the United States targeting North Korea or the United States targeting Cuba 90 miles away, to the extent that you open up means you're also opening up to a more powerful adversary who can use covert operations, intelligence operations, money, all kinds of things, and in tandem with each other. I think it's important for the audience because we live in America, the biggest country, richest country in the world, as they put it, not richest for all the people of the country, but, you know, wealthy. It has a lot of resources compared, say, to North Korea. North Korea's military budget, by the way, is the same size, this is a statistic we've used before, is the New York City Police Department budget. So against the United States, which spends formerly $700 billion a year on war, maybe $1 trillion. I want to read, John Kiriakou, back to when Kim Jong-un became the leader of North Korea because he succeeded his father. His father was Kim Jong-il, and Kim Jong-il died in December 2011. I'm looking at a BBC news story from that time period, and here's the headline. Kim Jong-il death. Did U.S. intelligence fail? And then I want to read these sentences to you, John, and see if this makes sense to you, because it's in line with our story here. Here we go. BBC. Modern intelligence gathering with its satellites and drones operating at the very cutting edge of technology can often give decision makers an extraordinary window on the world. Think of the amazing images earlier this year of U.S. President Barack Obama and his national security team in the White House watching live video of the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan as it unfolded. But the intelligence gatherers do not know everything, and North Korea is a point. U.S. analysts were still uncertain of Kim Jong-il's death some 48 hours after his demise early on Saturday morning. It's really, really stunning for such a powerful intelligence apparatus as the U.S. when the leader of North Korea died in 2011, they didn't know. That means they haven't penetrated the country the way they thought.
Yeah, that's exactly what it means. And going back even further, I know from a former State Department colleague that it was at least 10 days before the United States finally learned of the death of Mao in China in 1976. So you're right. You know, the CIA is not able to penetrate a lot of countries that the American people just assume they are able to penetrate. That intelligence is just not there.
Yeah, and one thing that, again, for our audience, people here in the United States have been told for a long time, it's a rogue state, it's an isolated state, it's an uneducated state, it's kind of a peasant state, it has this messianic form of government, hero worship. In other words, a description of a country that really can't compete with the U.S., at the level of intelligence or at the level of technology. And of course, it's a developing country, a formerly colonized country, so a poorer country. But when you look at the way things have shaped out in the last year and a half, John, with ICBM technology now being perfected by DPRK, the hydrogen bomb that they developed with their own indigenous technology. And what it seems to me is that they have a very, they've crafted a very sort of thoughtful, long-range strategy to be where they are now, where Donald Trump, the head of state of the United States, possibly meeting for the first time with the head of state of the DPRK. That in itself is a remarkable shift in the political relationship.
It truly is. And it goes to show you that what the North Koreans have been saying for all these years, that they wanted to be treated with respect and that they wanted to be treated as an equal, was true. That is what they've been seeking all these years.
And, you know, Trump is being attacked right now because he said Kim Jong-un is an honorable and open person following him walking in on Pompeo's meeting. Maybe that had the desired impact of the North Korean maneuver there. But that, in turn, would be very well recognized in North Korean culture to call Kim Jong-un an honorable person. You know, back in the day when they left the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, it was partly because George W. Bush was making fun of and calling Kim Jong-il names,
yes,
while at the same time signaling an end to the thaw.
Just like his father did in Iraq with Saddam Hussein, calling him Saddam Hussein. Saddam in Arabic means to force or to coerce. It's a very strong name. Saddam means shoeshine boy. So there's a lot behind this. There's a lot about saving face that's true.
Yeah. And again, here we are on the cusp. I mean, tomorrow will be, well, our time, it'll be tonight, the North-South meeting where a possible peace treaty will be signed, following by Trump visit to meet Kim Jong-un, maybe in Pyongyang. I don't know where it'll be because, of course, we don't know. We're not a fly on the wall. Maybe nobody knows yet. But nonetheless, when you look at this whole trajectory, if you just pit intelligence service versus intelligence service, it doesn't tell the whole story. The North Koreans want something. They want a national security guarantee from Americans rather than a guarantee that we're going to try to totally annihilate you.
That's right.
It's a bottom line. They know where they want to end here.
And you know, that's why I think this is actually going to end well. Perhaps it's true that only Trump can go to North Korea, just like only Nixon could go to China.
We're going to leave it there. That was John Kiriakou. I'm Brian Becker. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day in the Washington, D.C. area, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can also follow us at SputnikNews.com or subscribe to us as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. La 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 la
Thank you.